Welcome to this very crowded room this morning, and thank you for getting up early enough. This panel, to make sure you're in the right room, is Building Products with Passionate Users. My name is Matthew Hahn. I am going to be the moderator for the panel today. I work at Last.fm, where I run the product team out of London. And before we get started and I introduce you to these fine people, I want to find out who you guys are a little bit. So we're going to start off by asking the question, how many people in this room are part of product development or product marketing? Can I see a raise of hands? Awesome. That's a good number of hands. How many of you are more on the marketing side? Okay. How many in design? How many designers do we have in the room? Cool. How many of you have social in your title? How many of you used to be called community managers till it became a fad and it became social managers? Okay. Any founders or startup folks here who are also good? Okay, cool. Thank you for letting us know who you are. The people who have kindly agreed to be on this panel, I'm going to start on my right with Suzanne Stefanik. Suzanne, tell us who you are and tell us a product other than your own that you are passionate about.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Stefanik. I've been toiling in these waters for about 25 years. It's more fun now than ever. I most recently was heading up an innovation lab at the American Film Institute, and it was my great pleasure to watch a lot of people who are extremely passionate figure out how to build and launch their products. And so I'm excited to see all of you in the audience and to know what you're doing. I think I actually have two products that I am pretty passionate about. One of them is Last.fm, which Matthew is head of product for. I'm a music fanatic, and it turns out to be the best resource for me when it comes to discovery and finding new music. There's just such a plethora out there, and so how do you find it? And I think especially their partnership with Spotify has made that really easy. And so that's something that I'm just personally passionate about, and that's for pleasure. Flipboard, I think, is more pleasure for work, something where I have to every day go online and find information and stay up to date and make it personalized, make it be exactly what I want. I find that Flipboard not only does that, but it's beautiful, and so it gives me pleasure. It's like a joy to use, and so I think that finding that mix between work and play is where there's sort of a magic moment.
Fantastic. On my left, Mr. Dave Haynes. Tell us about you and your product you love.
Yeah, so my name's Dave Haynes, and I'm part of the growing team at SoundCloud. If anyone's not familiar with SoundCloud, we're the leading platform on the web for capturing and sharing sounds. So we have a community of around 11 million users now. On the music side, that could be everything from, you know, bands, artists, musicians, producers. But we have a really large growing community of users using it for everything from journalism, politics, sharing everyday sounds, poetry, comedy. So, lots of different users making up lots of different kind of sub-communities at SoundCloud. I think to answer the question about, favorite products, from a SoundCloud perspective, I mean, we were, you know, early on, we were very heavily influenced by other communities like Vimeo and Flickr, and we drew a lot of inspiration from their product, you know, having this community of creators at the heart. But personally, I would say Instagram. I've just been really impressed. They've managed to keep the product exceptionally simple, yet grow such a kind of a really kind of dedicated user base. And also, just keeping one of the things that we like to do at SoundCloud is just keep the product really simple. You know, at Instagram, it really is just about sharing one piece of content, a photo. Yet they've managed to, with their APIs, they've been able to kind of build all these different use cases around the one very, very simple product. So yeah, for me, that's one that I'm really passionate about.
Fantastic. And Farai?
Hi. I'm so excited to be here, and I have to give mad props to Matthew for putting this together. And I'm also a big Last.fm fan. I found myself trying to send that song, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday. And then I got into, like, all of these. So one of my obsessions is black people, you know. Baratunde also thought about that. But I was noticing how many black people there were in sort of like the 80s kind of crossover new wave ska, whatever bands, and through Last.fm. Somebody and it could be me, but it probably won't be. Somebody's got to do like a map of like where all the black people from the 80s British bands and Scottish bands ended up. I found out that the guy from the Thompson Twins is now a hypnotherapist in LA, and if I still live there, I could go and see him. But I moved back to the East Coast. As far as products that are not, I worked at Etsy. I'm still an advisor. I'm a huge fan of Etsy and all things Etsy. But Camera Plus is one of my huge favorites because it makes my pictures look better than they would otherwise. And then also I use Hootsuite, which I love parts of it and I don't love parts of it. But since I keep using it, it must be one of my favorites.
Sometimes passion is actually a love-hate relationship, right? A thin line between love and hate. Thank you guys for that. Let's start off the first question I kind of want to dig into, and I'm going to aim this direction for you guys. Both Etsy and SoundCloud rely on their audience to generate the content and the goods that they sell, right? So you don't have much content without your users on that side. In the earliest days of the platform, for both of you, what community outreach did you do? Where did you find those passionate users that help you get started? What worked and what didn't work in those periods of time when you were trying to identify those folks?
Let's get rid of that.
Yeah, so I mean, I'd say for us, I mean, early on, it was really important to, you know, seed the platform with the type of users who, you know, the product we already had a great fit for. You know, they could instantly get stuck in and use the product. And I mean, one of the things that we thought about when designing SoundCloud was really to think about the next step. So every time somebody used the platform, you know, the product almost spread itself. So by getting those kind of, you know, heavy users who were influencers within their own different communities, you know, with so many different use cases, we might have somebody using it for a completely different type of thing, but they would spread the product within their tight groups. So it was, you know, very much based on kind of influence and power users at the beginning. But then, as you know, it was really those guys that grew SoundCloud. We didn't kind of force it with any marketing or anything, but we did recognize very early on that, you know, out of those, you know, like early influencers, you know, there was a community that was growing about that. So one of the things that we did very quickly was to actually get somebody in, you know, before we had a marketing team or before we had, you know, like a VP of marketing and things like that. You know, one of the first things was really just to say, right, we need somebody in to, you know, come and manage that community and listen to that community so we can build the product further.
Right, Etsy?
Yeah, one of the things about Etsy that I really learned is I came in, you know, about 5 years into the company, and it started out as a community of people who were creators. And so one of the things is that there's this DNA in the company of people who, like the original fans, were people who knew how to sew or knew how to do pottery or knew how to do carpentry, which the founder did. And they were people who, you know, built a platform that they wanted to use. And so the expansion of the product and the fan base came out of that idea that we are people who know how to do craft and who respect, you know, individual enterprise and respect being, you know, often sole proprietors or working in small groups. And then as it grew to, you know, 800,000 plus shops, you know, it became a place with a more heterogeneous base. And one of the things we learned from the community is that, you know, and this is true of so many communities that I think many of us have been a part of, that not necessarily commercial communities, is that there sometimes are tensions between, you know, sort of, you know, the OGs and the people who come later, about what a community should be. Some of the people who came in later were some of the power sellers. Like, for example, T-shirts. If you come up with the right type of T-shirt based on Etsy's rules, if you take a commercially made T-shirt and screen print it, that means that it's handmade under Etsy's rules. And so some of the real power sellers are people who essentially do alterations of other types of products. And then some of the older school folks who are like, I sewed this with a whip stitch and a cross stitch and a whatever, and it took me 12 years to make this one thing. They're not so excited about it. So tensions come up in both how you define what is allowed on your platform and how you allow it to be marketed and all that.
So as those kind of passionate users started to emerge, on your platforms. Where were they coming from? Were they coming from message boards that you put up? Were they coming from, you know, people emailing you? Were they coming from the city you started in? Where were some of the, where did you find the source of some of these folks?
Well, I think that a lot of the passionate users came out of, for Etsy. So, for example, I gave a talk recently at the American Craft Council about social marketing for crafters. And I brought up an example of this woman who runs a shop. Her name's Jasmine. She runs a shop called Ghibri Online, and it does plus size fashion, and I've bought her clothes. I almost wore one of them today, but it was a little impractical for the weather. And she was someone who found an international audience for her designs by using Etsy. And so I think a lot of the community came out of people who already had a craft and had mastered their craft. And then sometimes they found it through local groups. So there's teams at Etsy. So sometimes people found the local teams and then kind of got into the whole thing. And sometimes they were just people who were like, I know I'm really good at what I do, but there's not that many people in my town that are going to buy what I do. Where's the platform that's going to help me get to a national and international audience? And then they found the product and became huge evangelists.
Cool, thanks. Suzanne, I want to ask you a question on that same front around some of the projects you worked on at the AFI had real fan bases to them. Clearly, they were people that were maybe there already an established fan base, but were there some projects that maybe weren't as established with a fan base that had to build it from some point? And can you talk a little bit about some of those projects as opposed to an automatic base for those?
Absolutely. I'll start with one that I worked on after the AFI, but because it's sort of, I'm going to work from the most obvious to the least obvious. So there's the show Glee, which, you know, has 15 million fans on Facebook, and it's huge. And so they already had an established fan base, but they weren't doing very much. And Fox got smart and put together a very smooth, sweet set of interactive environments, mostly based in Facebook, and the numbers just skyrocketed, and people just became very excited, and it became a dialogue between the showrunners and the fans. Not so incidentally, they ended up with a Emmy nomination for the interactive media. And so here you have a case of an established fan base that you would say, well, they're already really big, they don't need help, but it really bumped all the numbers, and it got everybody really excited.
Did they feel that that product, and I consider it a product, and it wasn't, I mean, you've always got a TV show that's the product, did they consider that part of what they were making, or is it something that was just a marketing exercise for them?
Fox is a little bit unique. I work a lot with all of the TV networks, all the big broadcast ones, and I also work with the Emmys, and it's been an interesting thing. Fox and Bravo have been really the savviest about this. They see it as integrated from the beginning in their storytelling. It's not something that's necessarily just tacked on to the end. And so Fox, in this case, worked with a company called Coincident, and they have a technology that made it very simple to insert any kind of interactivity into any frame of the video. And so when you view it through their player, just as HTML can connect to any object on the web, so can so now they can do with the video. This made it easy for the producers. If they came up with an idea, they could just do it, and it was like really simple. And I think this is huge, especially for the big networks and all. They're big, but they don't necessarily have big staffs. So if they have to hire three people to make this happen, they aren't going to do it. If an intern can do it, why not? So I think it's sort of the idea is more important than the depth of the technology. There are simpler, flatter ways to do it. Moving up the line, so you know, how many people are fans of Star Wars? Yeah, right. So, there are a lot of them. Duo in New York City, a guy named Casey Pugh and a woman named Annalise Pruitt had a kind of crazy idea, and they cut up the entire movie into 15-minute segments. It ended up that there were 473 of those, and they put them up online, and they said to people, remake this 15 seconds any way you want. They got thousands and thousands and thousands of people submitted these little 15-second segments, which when you strung them together, did ultimately retell the story. And it was the exact same story, but told in this myriad number of ways. It was as though you looked at the story through all these prisms. And I was working with the Emmys at the time. I was chairing the interactive media working group for the awards there. And when this came in as a project, you know, there was a lot of discussion about, is this television? Should it even be allowed? But it was so fascinating, and the numbers were just so compelling. You know, the idea that it was just crazy, the popularity of it. And so it was voted that it could be allowed in the voting, and it won the Emmy for interactive media that year. And so I felt like that was a huge jump, because especially something like the Emmys, where they're very delicate about maintaining their brand and about non-proliferation and kind of keeping it, they want it to seem very vaulted, that it's a really kind of pristine and high-level award. And the fact that it now could go to something that was crowdsourced, that, you know, was utterly unique and that took advantage of new technologies and new trends. And it rewarded this duo for coming up with an idea that just clicked. It just really, really, really worked.
In terms of this, is something that has come up with each one of you guys who talked about the importance of creators or makers in your mm-hmm. product, and how do you identify them as part of that process? You know, people who are making products have to make decisions all the time, and they often make decisions that their passionate users really hate. And they're often very proprietary. These are some of your happiest users, they're your most active users. How do you balance the expectations around ownership of the product, which ultimately a product person in a company has to own, versus the reality of running a business, versus the conversation you're going to have with your audience? What's the right balance to be set there?
I think you never lie. I think that the new transparency sort of demands that you always tell the truth. That said, sometimes you don't tell, you choose how to tell the truth. So we were having a discussion earlier, and I was saying, rather than saying to your most passionate users, what would you like to see, because then you get this vast bucket of potential ideas that could happen, and people feel invested in it, and they feel like you should have done their thing that they submitted, maybe you categorically present to them the types of things that you are able to do and that are on your horizon, and then you can start to build a topography of interest for your user base. I think that this is a good trick.
Dave, I know this is something you guys have talked quite about at SoundCloud, and how you get users involved in the platform for things you can and can't do. So talk a little bit about how that's worked at SoundCloud.
Yeah, I mean, some examples. I was actually just another example came to mind of we had a set of passionate users at the beginning who were using the product in a particular way, and that example we had this feature on SoundCloud called private sharing. So a typical use case, an early case would be I would be a musician. I have a list of a growing list of people who I want to get my music to. So I'm gonna share it to them on SoundCloud. I start following them. We start interacting, and then I'm sharing a track to 1,000 people, then 2,000 people, and then 3,000 people. And early on, I mean, that was a really great in a way it was a great product feature, because it meant it was implicit in the way people were using the platform that was how the product got shared, because those artists would have their lists of 1,000 or 2,000 people. And those people would have to become engaged in SoundCloud to actually go and listen to that track. But then, as we start getting bigger, and as we started getting closer towards, not like 50,000 people, but 10 million people, that activity was something that was almost becoming, I kind of hesitate to say spam-like, but, there was a lot of people saying, we're going to use this feature, to try and grab people's attention, on the platform. So it was something we had to do a lot of analysis around. The product team ran a lot of numbers. We looked at, we could see there was this kind of, blip, that in the curve you could see there was this very, very small proportion of users who were using the feature in that particular way. But in many ways, those were the people who had been on board since the very early days and, were so passionate that they would claim that, they were the kind of the really people who were driving, driving SoundCloud and using it in the right way. So I think sometimes you just have to, you have to take tough decisions. And especially, I think, as you start getting bigger, the decisions do get tougher. But it's usually best to, look first at what you can take away than, just start adding things for those kind of, tip of the iceberg users.
It's Suzanne's point about giving them an area to focus on. I mean, you talked a little bit about finding the passionate users and maybe giving them a task or something you can get them to work on in an area that's, hey, let's go over here. Let's all go this direction. Has that worked for you guys? And is there an example you can think of that's you've said, we can't do these 57 other things, but we really are really interested in this part of it. How do you draft these people into your product organization?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that was actually something I was listening to a fantastic panel yesterday, and the community manager of Foursco was saying exactly that. You know, they have, you know, for those passionate users, they actually say, you know, rather than just let them, you know, have a, you know, one-way dialogue of, hey, we want this feature and hey, we want that feature, you know, if you can actually empower those users and give them a job, give them, I mean, don't, you don't have to necessarily pay them, but give them a task and let them feel a bit of ownership of the product. You don't, you know, the feedback that they give you, you don't necessarily have to take that on board. And, you know, in many ways, it's the job of the community manager to actually, you know, take that feedback and then prioritize it and send it back to the product team. But, you know, if you've kind of given them a glimpse into the decision-making process, or you're rolling out, you know, early beta features, you know, we're just about to kind of start rolling out a few things at SoundCloud. It's, you know, like, can we identify a group of users who would be, you know, great, you know, like an early feedback system as well. So you can use those passionate examples, those passionate users to your advantage, and you just have to create the right forum for that.
Yeah, Suzanne?
You know, I think if you think of it like game theory, if you create an environment that it's almost like a leaderboard environment where you can allow these people to kind of be elevated within, have more visibility within the community, and almost like a point system or something, that works again and again and again.
And I think with, you know, with Etsy, the Etsy app came out of the handmade code contest where they basically, you know, opened up to people who wanted to use the API and to create something out of it. So there was this Etsy Lovers app, which was, you know, a third-party app and a contest winner, and Etsy acquired it and the team that made it, and it's the Etsy app, and it's been downloaded over a million times. So that's a very large-scale example of, you know, taking, you know, your fans and making them into your team. But I think that there's always a lot of different ways, ranging from, you know, message board feedback to, you know, to frankly legal challenges to, you know, questions of intellectual property that then shape what your product looks like.
Yeah, I think that's an important point about the, you know, who owns the platform is always a challenge in this. Like, there's a lot of people, as I say, feel very proprietary about the things they create on it. For us at Last.fm, we've always had an open API, and because we generate so much data, we really strongly believe that the data belongs to the user, but the platform is ours. So how do we open it widely enough, but also remember that the platform is, you know, is what we make our money from? You know, yeah. So there's always that hard balancing act, I think. To shift this a little bit, let's talk about identifying the people and is it in the work in your companies, whose job is it? Like, and let's kind of be specific, I think. Is this product's job to keep an eye on the community? Is it marketing's? Is it who in the company really owns the relationship with these fans? And in Etsy, for your title at Etsy, I think was an interesting one. It was VP of Voice at one point, right?
Exactly.
Can you explain what that meant and what that meant in this context?
It was a completely made-up title that I enjoyed tremendously when I had it. But basically, I worked with the marketing and supervised the marketing, social media, blog, and video teams. So producing original content mainly for, you know, sort of the community, but with a larger ripple effect, and then also, you know, reaching out into the marketplace. One team that was not kind of under my umbrella was, well, two teams that weren't, were the community team and then a team that deals with the forums, which are in some ways like the oldest of old school communication. They're just message boards. But we all ended up working together because I think in the end so the forums are dealing with kind of direct feedback in text form underneath item listings or, you know, underneath you know, postings by Etsy. Community deals with teams and events and really doing that kind of community-based outreach. And then among the groups that I helped supervise were people who were making content, some of the beautiful videos that are about, you know, the Etsy makers, and then also the marketing and the partnerships that went with that. And so all of those groups, some of which I worked with directly, some of which I didn't, really had to do with, you know, the public face of Etsy, but also then extracting product wisdom. So one of the things that we found was that one of the barriers to participation was taking good photos. And so then we created different ways, some of them product-based and some of them also just sort of like instructional video-based, to help people create better photos of the items they had to sell. Because if you have a crappy photo of a beautiful necklace, then you're not going to get anyone to buy it. So you sometimes there are things that then result in both product innovation and in kind of like this community and information flow. And it's not one or the other. It can be both.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, there's probably kind of two teams that address this area the most. I mean, first of all, we have a really tremendous marketing team who are very kind of data driven and product driven. So, you know, through that we can, you know, by using the data from how our users are actually using the platform, you know, we can draw a lot of conclusions to that. We do a lot of sending out regular surveys to our users, just taking a sample of the user base and getting their feedback, and then benchmarking that month by month. So, you know, we're kind of very, you know, we like our product to be informed a lot by the data that's being generated by the users themselves. But I would say probably really the front line is driven by our awesome community team. I mean, they really are the front line. You know, like, they're the first place that the users are going to come when they've got a problem, or that, you know, it might not just be problems. We get a lot of people just reaching out to say, hey, you know, we really love this, or, you know, and even getting audio messages back from some of them. So,
well, one of the things I hear people talk a lot about at product organizations is who gets to control the social media channels. And I think the successful ones are often the ones who are in their customer service elements, right? If you've got a and this, I think, especially works for companies who don't necessarily have a maker focus, like I think most of the people on this panel do, but those people who actually put their community managers in charge of the social media, because they're a lot closer to the front line itself.
Yeah, that, I mean, for us, I think community goes, you know, way beyond just kind of doing social media. I think if you have a community manager who's just kind of, you know, checking emails and doing Twitter and Facebook, that's, you know, probably not the kind of, you know, you're not using that team as much as you can. I mean, first and foremost, you know, the community team has to be in the trenches, you know, taking support tickets, getting back to users, getting their feedback. You know, in terms of informing product, you know, that we can then take that feedback. It's like, hey, you know, we've had 20 emails about this particular thing, or we've had, you know, this many people request a particular feature, or, you know, quite often if there's a particular bug in a product, then it's the community team that actually flags that first and has to, you know, flag it up to the engineers. But there, I mean, in terms of connecting with the users, there's a lot of incoming, but we try and do a lot of proactive outgoing as well. So really connecting with those users. One thing that we just rolled out was a program called SoundCloud Heroes that we just announced yesterday, actually. So we have, you know, we've found users in particular communities. So yesterday I met up with our hero for Austin and our hero for Chicago, and they're really passionate users who are now, you know, they're almost an extended part of the SoundCloud community team. We had another program called Fellowships, where we actually, you know, we had a user and it was kind of giving them that task. We were like, hey, you know, like, go out and work on your project and we'll kind of fund and support that project. And actually one of our fellows, I think he's just sitting down in the corner there, but one of our fellows actually did such an awesome job that he, you know, suddenly became part of the full-time team at SoundCloud. Other things, you know, Global Meetup Day, where we have just, you know, we might have hundreds of cities. We pick one day and lots of our users get together. And, you know, again, those just provide really good forums for those, you know, the most passionate users to identify themselves and have some interaction, you know, like in the greater community of SoundCloud.
Sometimes I think that people see the community base as a vast, undifferentiated morass, which you come up with a strategy. I kind of think you need three strategies. There's the 2% strategy. The numbers are arbitrary, but you've got your very small, super active base. These are people who post all the time, who comment on other people's things, who upload new video or whatever. You know, like they're really involved. Those are the ones you want to, those are going to be your long-term amplifiers. And you want to figure out how to really court them, and that's where the leaderboard thing comes in. I think that there's a second level, maybe the 20%, and those are people who are relatively active. They comment sometimes. They'll favorite things. You know, they're kind of they're involved. They occasionally might actually contribute something or upload it. And then you've got your 80% who are actually kind of your passive viewers, but they're consuming all the time. And the fruits of those other two groups are what keep them really excited, I think, a lot of the time. So you kind of it pays off in the end to be thinking about at least three tiers and have somewhat different strategies or tiered strategies that you use for those.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in. I mean, I think that's a really great point. And we see a lot of people when they're, you know, kind of in their onboarding process, SoundCloud, you know, they might have signed up for an account and they might have made one comment on a particular track, you know, that their friends posted. Or it might be, you know, I just wanted to, you know, record one sound and share that to my Facebook wall. And a lot of those early users, they come into it and, our product serves a specific need at a specific time. But we kind of see this funnel where, you know, I think for us and for the community team especially, there's this really golden moment when, you know, a user suddenly realizes that there is this huge community on the platform itself. And we see tweets, you know, somebody had tweeted like, oh wow, I've been, you know, I'm a long-term fan of SoundCloud, but I've only just discovered the community element. And I think one of the things that we really try and focus on in the community team is, you know, if we can get the users that have kind of reached that tipping point, if they can drag more people into that, then that
the
becomes
amplification.
It's really powerful.
I think that there's a real challenge there, I think, to get to scale and that a lot of us need in our businesses. You can't just rely on the passion users. You're going to have some people who are going to be maybe, I don't want to call them less passionate or dispassionate about your products. But do you think there really is a funnel that you can move them through? You can move some of those users who are the more passive folks into, let's call them, you know, your middle 20%?
Again, I think you use those lures that work so well in gaming. You know, you create these little jumps where if you post three times, you get a plus, and if you get three of those, you're on the leader. Your name shows up. I think people love to see their name online, and if it's something where if they've done something and they can send it to their 40 friends on Facebook or their 200 friends on Facebook, that they're today's star, you know, and somewhere, that's a huge amplification vehicle for you.
Yeah, I mean, one thing with the, I mean, I definitely agree, you know, creating that kind of system to get people more engaged. But I think especially early on, you know, something that we talked about very early on, you know, could we reward people with extra minutes or extra bonus stuff? And I think you do need to be careful because as your product is growing, if you put that kind of game structure around it, if you set the wrong rules, then you're screwed. You know, it's very difficult to take those points away or change them. And I think sometimes it's really kind of looking towards the human need of those users. If something, you know, I don't necessarily need points, but if I've posted a piece of audio and someone's left me a time comment or someone's liked my, I mean, I going back to my Instagram example, I was using it and then the more that people liked my photos, the more I, you know, continued creating. I didn't necessarily need reward from the product itself.
That's
more
kind of what I'm saying. If you elevate them as a personality within your world, that's a huge gain for them.
And I think that can also be local as well as system-wide. I mean, most of the products that really go to scale end up having either a national or international component. And then you can return to a question of what does region have to do with your product? You know, every product is different. For some, regionality is much more important than others. But everything, you know, like, you know, having self-hosted events by people who are fans of your product is really important because, you know, the people are social creatures and we want to connect with each other in one way or the other. So a lot of times what you do is you start out with, you know, a hyper-local base that is the creators of the product, you know, the people who are coding or marketing or whatever, and the fan base that they build. And then you go to some sort of scale that includes people in all sorts of different regions, nationally and internationally, and then you can sort of put down some roots and create these communities that have all sorts of interactions that you might not have even envisioned around commerce. You know, if people are selling different products and they don't, you know, for, let's say, for ecological reasons, want everything shipped, you know, can they identify, you know, and this is one thing that many different products, Etsy included, have done, is saying, like, if you don't really want to participate in shipping and you want to keep things more local, you might be able to go drive over and pick up something from someone, or they might come. I've had people deliver stuff to me, just like say, oh yeah, no, I'll meet you at such and such a place. And so there's all sorts of different bonuses that may not have even been a part of your plan that then get realized, particularly if you tap into how your growth has expanded geographically and also psychographically, because there are some people who want a high level of interaction. There's others who really are like, I just want my music, or I want my product, or I want whatever, and I don't want anybody talking to me, and all of you just go away.
A friend of mine said that about music. He said, I don't listen to music to be social. I listen to it to be antisocial. And I think there's a point to that, right? There's a certain level where you think about, we really become overamped on the social, right? It's like, oh, if we just add more social mojo to our product, we're going to be genius, and everyone wants to share stuff, right? And yeah, we're now in that point where we now have so much sharing, and frictionless sharing, frankly, pisses me off because it stopped being curation. It started being something else. But
yeah, one anecdote on that, on the kind of users who actually don't want to kind of, you know, be part of the community. I met one guy. I mean, he actually made the effort to come. I mean, he was such a passionate user. He came down to the first global meetup day that we did in London. There was just kind of, you know, 50 power users in the room, and most of them were saying about, hey, I'm, you know, this musician, or, you know, I've been sharing these stories on SoundCloud and sharing and, you know, talking about their play counts. I just hit 10,000 plays or something. And there was this one guy in the corner that I made an effort to go and speak to, and I was like, how do you use SoundCloud? And his main use case was he never shared. He would make a track, but he wouldn't have the confidence to publish them. But what he really liked was when he uploaded them to SoundCloud, we put a waveform on the page, and he was like, oh, I'm so excited to see what the waveform of my music looks like. And that was it, you know, for him, that was it. That was the be all and end all. That was his one thing. So, you know, you really can't kind of, you know, paint the whole community with the same paintbrush.
Cool. I really want to take some time to take questions. We have about 20 minutes left. So I'm going to take questions, and if you can, get to the microphone. But if not, shout it out, and I will try to repeat the question. So,
you talked a lot about managing passionate users, but how do you get from zero to passionate users?
So the question was, managing passionate users, how do you go from zero to a number?
Yeah. Cool, but how do you start acquiring users?
Cool.
Well, you know, without being cagey, I think part of it depends on the product. I mean, some products are more essential than others. And so, for example, if your product involves people making money or people marketing themselves in ways that will make them money, let's face it, the commercial aspect is important. A lot of the other products that have to do with personal satisfaction around, let's say, everything from, you know, the arts to hyper-local neighborhood issues, they may not work on a commerce base, but they may be as important. So you really have to figure out, I mean, that's really the psychology part of it, is once you figure out what the root, let's say that you're talking about a hyper-local engine that combines content and tools about a specific neighborhood. And what is the need that needs to be fixed? Is it a neighborhood in transition where a lot of new people are moving in and they need to meet each other, in which case you might go to an events-based strategy of just having some people get together? Is it something about people have lived in this neighborhood for a long time, there's a crime problem, which is how can we have a town hall forum that puts local people together with, you know, people from government? And that's just one example, but really you have to figure out what the need is for what you do. And sometimes the need is just purely social, like let's get together and have a party. Sometimes it's more of bringing together different parties who may have a different perspective on the same thing, or creating a marketplace. But, you know, maybe people...
Talk about how, you know, Etsy and Last Event, like, how did each of you get started from zero to...
So I think from Last FM's perspective, we had a very sticky mechanism, right? Which is something that when you started tracking your music history, it became very addictive for people. So there's a mechanism there that gets you to repeat and become a daily user of our product in a certain way, or a passive user of the product. So that was one of the ways we got our acceleration. I think for people who don't have that kind of a mechanism, I think you have to look to the communities that are affiliated with your product that exist already. And that doesn't mean you go and spam the shit out of their forums. It means you go and participate and find out who they are and figure out how your product fits into their product, into their world. And I think that that's a hard step-by-step process that as Dave has pointed out and other people have pointed out, you get your community managers on early, because if you're not looking into the community, you're not going to get those users.
Sorry. And with Etsy, of course, it was people who had skills and talents and who could produce goods, but who were not able to access the right marketplace for those goods. So the people who started the company were people who were makers who then needed markets. And as they built markets, they found more makers. And so that was a very organic process.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that I think we did early on was, you know, we had a product that did super serve, and we targeted a specific group of users. Now that we're 11 million users, obviously we have this huge range of diverse use cases. But at the beginning, we actually started out in beta, and we spent a long time where it wasn't if you were somebody and you stumbled across SoundCloud, you couldn't use it. You had to be invited. So we had this we seeded it with a few people, and then they invited other people that were in their kind of group. So we had this really nice breeding ground. I think by the time we launched, we had maybe had a core of 40,000 users, but they were the ones using the product, and it best fit their needs at the time. I read a really great article. I can't remember, maybe someone in the audience knows, but there was an article by Paul Graham last week about kind of 8 ideas that probably shouldn't be done but would be amazing if they did. And he talked about, could somebody build a search engine that was, bigger than or became bigger than Google? And one point that he made was, you'd need to start, if you were trying to do something like that, invent a product like that, you would need to super serve a group of users. So if you could build a search engine that, was amazing for developers, you had one feature in there which allowed you to search for code snippets on the web better than any other product. And I think that's always it's a tricky one, because you then have to figure out, if you do have that really core user base of passionate users who have had one specific use case, how do you transition out of that? But if you make it too broad at the beginning, then you might just miss completely.
I would keep in mind, like within the Silicon Valley VC community, one word that just jumps out all the time is influencers. They want to know who are the influencers in your community. And I think if you focus on that, it'll help you to come up with the strategy that's appropriate to your community building.
Another question up front.
You mentioned how Etsy acquired a tool that was had built a passionate base, and my company was founded when Tumblr acquired our iPhone app. But how do you manage kind of the other side when you've got passionate users of a product that doesn't serve what you're trying to serve with your tools, but it's got this huge base, and like missing E with Tumblr, where there's huge backlash with what Tumblr tries to manage in that tool?
Yeah, I think Twitter had a similar problem with TweetDeck, right? I mean, there's a lot of people who were excited by TweetDeck, and all of a sudden they said, hey, we're not doing that anymore. So I think it's a real challenge initially to, that's what I was saying earlier about your business challenge and your passionate user challenge. They often go in different directions. I don't know there's an automatic answer to that one. I don't think there's an easy one other than to say your APIs have to be open, and sometimes they're going to do things you don't like. And you have to figure out how do you manage the APIs at that level or the access they get, while recognizing that that's part of being a platform. Sorry, other questions? Right down in front.
Tommy, can you worry about specifically Etsy? I mean, I'm not really an Etsy user, say, but my first introduction was to a friend who was. Mm-hmm. And she's the example of Regretsy.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, like, Regretsy, how does that fit into your user base? And is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing?
Yeah, the question was about Regretsy. I mean,
can you describe what Regretsy is?
Okay, I think from my perspective, and this is just me, Regretsy used to be like the humorous, oh my God, I can't believe they're making that crap kind of site. But then there's also, of course, many critiques of the company. And so Regretsy started moving into being kind of a voice of people who critiqued product. And those are two different functions. I mean, like Regretzi as the sort of, oh my God, I can't believe that they made that moose hat with, you know, the in pink, and we're going to put this on the site because it's ugly. That is, and of course, Regretzi actually helps sell things because a lot of people want really crazy, ugly stuff. And so that part is, and they made a book out of it. That's like one aspect. But then the other aspect of people critiquing the product. So Etsy has made some incredible changes to its product. For example, it moved from a purely PayPal-based system to being able to accept direct payments from people's accounts, bank accounts. There's all sorts of, I mean, like just like any company evolves. And so I think that on the more sort of like product critique side, in the same way that people look at the forums, people also look at what's posted on Regretzi. People look at, this site doesn't do as much critiquing, but more describing. Auction Bites, which is a very influential website that deals with online commerce. And we, you know, at Etsy, it's like, let's look at all of the different critiques of products and then also realize, well, that's great that you critique this, but we're not going to change this. Or thanks for the information. This is not a priority right this second. There's all sorts of tiered, you know, but I don't think that anyone hates it. It's just sort of like how you deal with the different streams of critique.
Communities are clearly places with conflict. I think being able to deal with conflict has to be built into it. There was a question over here.
Hi, I am a seller and buyer on Etsy. I love it so
much. Yay!
And I'm also a passionate user of Pinterest.
Yes.
But I also fit the demographic.
Well, I think with Etsy, it's clear. I mean, as I often talk to people, you know, not so much at a place like South by Southwest Interactive, but when I talk to people, I'm like, Etsy, it's like men, women, you know, it's just like it's just clear that, you know, there's a difference in how people react to the name of the company and the concept. A lot of people who I've been talking to, I'm like, blah, 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 Etsy. And it's like, let's say it's a husband and a wife. The guy will be like, uh-huh. And the wife will be like, that's where our napkins are from. The, you know, the handmade linen ones that we use at the dinner parties, you know. And I do think that there's, you know, for example, you know, men who buy on Etsy tend to buy big ticket items, either as gifts for other people or for themselves. You can buy a $100,000 piece of furniture on Etsy, as well as, you know, fine jewelry, as well as something that costs literally 10 cents. So it's a very heterogeneous market in terms of the products. And I think that part of, you know, part of the ongoing work is just to sort of explain the wide variety of products that are available. And then the gender segmentation may change. But thank you.
Question in the back. Sorry, I'm.
So in today's social platforms, right, there's many of them that you can pull together in order to get the message across. I just thought maybe you could speak to some of the tools, because I know that tools is a whole category in and of itself. But
yeah.
What are some of the things that you find surprisingly helpful in understanding your audience beyond your community?
I'll try to repeat that question. Basically, what kind of tools, social tools, are useful in building these passionate users, and can each of the folks talk about that?
And understanding them as they change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a. Let's start over here. Suzanne, you want to talk about the social tools a little bit from your perspective? What's been successful on some of the projects you've worked on?
So some of the most obvious things, Twitter and Facebook, you know, I mean, you can build great deep tools that are internal to your system. But in fact, if you're reaching out to where their communities already exist and where they already have tendrils that are themselves able to spur the next group, I think don't discount that. Build really good strategies for the social networks that already exist.
I'm gonna be a bit of a contrarian about Facebook a little bit. I think that the social graph and the interest graph aren't always equal, and despite Facebook and Google's attempts to put them on top of each other forcibly, that it's really important for the individual smaller communities that exist out there to continue to own the interest graph. So I think it's important not to overlook other communities that exist that are along your alignment. If you're a rock climbing tool, you should be on the rock climbing forums and not just trying to focus only on Facebook. It's a powerful tool, and you can't not be there. but also don't ignore the smaller interest networks or the areas. Those are really important. And don't forget
Google Plus. I really think Google Plus is wonderful, and it is still small, and there are still issues, but I would make it a three-pronged strategy.
And also, the lady over here mentioned Pinterest, which, of course, when I talk about social tools and social marketing, I point out exactly how many platforms there are. Sometimes people are baffled because, of course, Facebook and Twitter come to mind immediately. But, for example, Pinterest and Etsy are naturally, basically the treasuries on Etsy sort of psychographically link up really well with pinning and scrapbooking. And it's all, kind of in the same mental creative zone. And so one of the things I always point out to people, for example, I gave in wearing my other hat as a journalist, which is what I do for the most part, I did a training on social media for public media producers, people who do documentaries and people who do TV shows. And I was like, this is a list of 15 different social tools. Are you running a campaign for a specific launch, like for a documentary that's launching? Are you running, kind of social interaction for an ongoing product like a TV show? Blah, 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 blah. And you can apply that to anything. There's so many different platforms. It's just really about finding the platform that suits you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The question wasn't so much about the platforms. There's a ton of platforms.
Right.
The data behind those platforms. Is it?
Yeah.
Well,
you find Graph, you use Radian6, or there are other tools that you found very useful to aggregate that community.
Well, what I'll say briefly before turning it over to much wiser minds is also, it's like, are you talking about a walled garden, or are you talking about something where you really still control the data? I mean, Facebook is, very much, some people don't mind. Like, there was a great article on The Guardian, the British publication, and how they use Facebook and how they don't care that it's a walled garden and most of the interaction takes place there. But it's also a question of how much do you want to import and export the data, and how much do you want to own it? So,
Dave, do you have a comment? LastFM has a fair amount of data, and we spend our own internal data. So we spend a whole lot of time on that and on our web analytics. I think you need to spend, if you're a web-based platform or if you're a mobile platform, you need to be doing your own metrics on your own users first. And if you don't get that right, no amount of Facebook insight or YouTube insight is going to help you. You got to know that first.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, this isn't really my area of specialty, but we have a team of analysts. It started off as one person very early on, but now we're growing that team and the competencies. And, obviously there's a lot you can do just with simple tools that are available to everyone, things like Google Analytics. Some companies outgrow Google Analytics, but, when you have a platform that's, scaling extremely quickly, going really fast, being able to get that data is not the easiest task. You have to put resources into setting those systems up. And we now have a good system where, every day, certain people in the company get a set of like analytics, which are really crucial for the whole company. But then, we know that we're only kind of, a request on a Google form away from getting something very specific. Thinking about how that really scales when you're crunching a lot of data is crucial to solve that problem. Because if you don't have that insight when you're building the product, then I think you're going to be lost.
It's really important also not to get too hung up on the tools themselves and understand what the question you're asking and who the audience you're after. And that's why I say focus on your own internal metrics first. They'll tell you a lot about what's going on.
Also, I think people are jumping beyond just mere impressions and clicks, and you need to really look at behaviors. And that's a little more complex, but you'll be much better rewarded.
Yeah. I think we have time for one more question. Two, okay. More? Right there. Thanks.
You maybe talk about there was a panel about anonymous users and whether or not they have a much insight. Do you have a passionate, anonymous user base? Or
yeah. I think you have to be able to recognize the antisocial users that Dave described as well, the people who don't want to be as talkative and their passions may be different, right? And that's why I think Suzanne's point about behavior is really critical on that. If you can identify behaviors that are passionate behaviors on your site that aren't maybe as social or as flamboyant, they're still passionate users. I think you can see that in anonymous users. It's easier when you can track them, obviously, but if you can't track them, recognizing where people are doing obsessive behavior in your site is actually a really good way to encourage those. Anyone else?
That's good.
Cool. Sorry.
Just one moment. One.
Yeah.
I don't think just to... So the question was, as the community grows, passion can decrease. I think it's more that, you know, many people have talked about the sort of hierarchy of users, like the sort of super users, the avidly interested in the I'm along for the ride. I think that, you know, strong communities start out with the top of that pyramid, and then often you build the bottom. And it's not that you have less of a fanatical or passionate base. It's that you're building a bunch of people who are more passively interested, who may also help you with your revenue model. And so it's about recognizing what do you have to offer to the people who are more sort of passing through, as well as engaging the people who are incredibly passionate.
Cool. One more question. I think we're going to then break. Is there one more? No? Awesome. Thank you guys very much for taking the time.